You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
But before we get to the information end of the podcast, we're delving into astronomy. And what better place to start than at the beginning? Zia, what do you think the Big Bang sounded like?
Kind of like a bang that was really, really big. Clues in the name?
No, it's more like this.
So at the beginning, it sounds like it's about to go into the theme tune of Doctor Who. Then it sounds a bit like a plane taking off. And sometimes it sounds a bit like a bee or a drill. Not quite what I was expecting.
That was actually an audio rendering of new measurements of the cosmic microwave background radiation, the afterglow of the Big Bang. That sound clip was produced by John G. Kramer, a professor of physics at the University of Washington, who used Mathematica to turn the data recently released by the European Space Agency's Planck satellite team into sound. You can find a link to more of his sound files and his explanation for how he produced them on the podcast page www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
The Planck satellite has been measuring hot and cold spots in the cosmic microwave background radiation, and in March, they announced their first cosmological findings. Seems there's been a shift in what we thought was the age of the universe and in its makeup. So we now have slightly different values for the amount of dark matter in the universe. That's the invisible matter that can't be seen directly through telescopes, but which exerts a gravitational pull on surrounding objects. And astronomers have also revised their estimates for the amount of dark energy in the universe. That's the mysterious stuff that seems to be pushing the cosmos apart and causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate.
You've probably read the headlines about the Planck release, and that's not the only dark matter announcement to have hit the news recently. A couple of weeks ago, astronomers announced the detection of certain antimatter particles by the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer on the International Space Station. That have been widely reported as finding the best hints of dark matter.
But don't get too excited yet, Brendan. Some of those announcements may have been slightly exaggerated, shall we say? So to mark this exciting month of cosmic results, we invited Katie Mack, an astrophysicist at the University of Melbourne in Australia, to put things into perspective for us. I spoke to her earlier and chatted through what these results really mean, and what we should be getting excited about. Before we turned to Planck, Katie began by explaining exactly what the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer detector was looking for, and what it found.
So AMS is a cosmic ray detector, and it's a little box that hangs off the side of the International Space Station, and it's looking for cosmic rays. So it's looking for electrons, protons, and the antiparticles of those, positrons for the electrons, and antiprotons, the antimatter version of the proton. And what it's able to do is it's able to detect the cosmic rays, and it's able to figure out what their energies are. And specifically, one of the aims of AMS is to look for antimatter that might come from dark matter annihilation.
So what did they find, actually? What was their announcement?
So their announcement was that they found more positrons than usual astrophysical models would suggest there should be. This same excess has been seen by two other probes, one called Pamela, which is an Italian satellite, and one called Fermi, which is a gamma ray satellite.
There have been a lot of headlines around about how these are the best hints we've had of dark matter so far. How is this result connected to dark matter? And would you say that, you know, this is the best signature of dark matter that we've seen?
No, it's definitely not. There have been a lot of headlines that have said that, you know, this is our best clue about dark matter. We've known about dark matter for a long time. We've had evidence of dark matter since, I think, the 1930s. And that evidence has just been getting more certain over the years. We know from looking at the way that galaxies are moving, we know from looking at the cosmic microwave background, gravitational lensing, collisions of clusters of galaxies, there are so many lines of evidence for the fact that dark matter exists. What we haven't seen, and what people are suggesting that AMS might be giving us some insight into, is we haven't seen particle physics interactions of dark matter, which is to say, we think dark matter is made of some kind of particle. We think that this particle probably has some kind of interaction with itself or with other particles, and we haven't seen any kind of interaction that we've been sure about. And specifically, the AMS detector, what it saw, this excess of positrons, is the kind of thing that you might expect from certain kinds of models of dark matter where the dark matter particle is its own antiparticle. So anytime a dark matter particle hits another dark matter particle, if it's a very direct collision, then there would be an annihilation, and that annihilation would produce cascaded particles, and some of those particles would be electron-positron pairs. And then that would raise the positron fraction, and you'd see some sign of it in something like one of these cosmic ray detectors. But that's not something that I would call evidence, in the sense that certain models of dark matter annihilation can produce a positron excess that looks kind of like what AMS saw, but other things can mimic the signal you're looking for. And one of the biggest ones, and the most important one for this purpose, is pulsars. So pulsars are very compact, sort of dead stars. They're neutron stars. They're made of basically super compact clumps of neutrons, and they spin very fast. They have this very strong magnetic field, and that magnetic field, it accelerates particles. And in that particle acceleration, it can produce electron-positron pairs. You know, it's well within the realm of possibility that the signal has nothing to do with dark matter at all, and it's just pulsar emission. So one of the other things that was discussed as being a sign that this signal might be dark matter was that it appeared from the data that the signal was coming from all directions equally. And that's actually kind of a subtle issue. Dark matter is not uniformly distributed throughout the universe. Dark matter is clustered where other kinds of matter are. In our galaxy, the dark matter is distributed throughout the galaxy. It's kind of a spherical blob in which our galaxy is sitting, and it's much more dense at the center. So, you know, really you wouldn't expect that dark matter annihilation wouldn't be happening equally in all directions. It would be happening more at the galactic center, but it turns out that the particles that AMS can detect can't propagate that far. So we wouldn't actually be able to see dark matter annihilation happening in the galactic center with something like AMS. But what we can probe is the dark matter that's more nearby. And if we can only detect the annihilation products from annihilation nearby, then you do expect that it should be coming roughly the same amount from each direction. But even that's a slightly more subtle point, because there are magnetic fields in the galaxy. And there's a very complicated magnetic field in our galaxy with little pockets going one way and going another way. So even if we had just one pulsar producing all of the signal that AMS is seeing, it would look like it was coming basically from all directions, because the particles, as they were coming toward us, would be flipped around and moved around in big arcs and redirected in such a way that signal would still look basically isotropic. And so the measure of how different it is in every direction that you're looking, the AMS experiment can measure, is not really sufficient to tell the difference between the signal coming from a few pulsars at specific points in the sky or coming from dark matter that's distributed kind of all around us, because the magnetic fields make that a really difficult thing to determine, and just fundamentally, the particles can't travel in straight lines.
So then going forwards, you know, there's been this excitement about dark matter, but as you say, there are other explanations, possibly more plausible explanations. How will astrophysicists now be trying to differentiate between these possibilities? Is it a case of running new experiments? Is it a case of getting more refined measurements from this particular detector, or running different experiments, or improving astrophysical models? Where do you go from here?
Well, all of the above, really. So one of the things that the AMS collaboration has suggested is that if they can measure the positron excess to somewhat higher energies, they might be able to see this rising signal turn around and drop off. And that kind of drop at high energies might be what you would expect for if this were dark matter annihilation, because basically the dark matter annihilation would not be able to produce particles that are a lot more energetic than the dark matter particles themselves were. So there should be some energy at which it won't be able to produce any higher energy positrons, and then you'd have sort of a drop-off of the signal at that point. However, that really wouldn't be definitive in any way, because not all models of dark matter annihilation have a very sharp drop-off. There are some that have a very smooth turnover in the signal, and also some pulsar models also have a sharp drop-off. It depends on various parameters of the model. So we really need other kinds of measurements. We need to look at gamma ray signals, we need to look at radio signals, we need to look at other methods of detection for dark matter. There are direct detection experiments where they have underground labs waiting for dark matter particles to run into their machines, the LHC might be able to produce dark matter particles. And so, you know, we need to continue those efforts. And then there are a number of other more indirect things where we can look for signals of dark matter annihilation in the early universe, or look for the effects of dark matter annihilation on the way that stars and galaxies are forming in the early universe, all kinds of things like that.
Okay, right. Now, I guess that just highlights how difficult it is to analyze the kind of data that comes out, because many things can mimic the same signal. So thank you very much there. And of course, there was another big result that came out in March. The scientists behind the Planck satellite released some data, and they were looking at the cosmic microwave background radiation, the sort of the relic radiation from the Big Bang. So first of all, Katie, let me ask you, we've seen maps of the cosmic microwave background before. The WMAP satellite, for instance, gave us, you know, fairly recently a very, very nice picture of the cosmic microwave background, and we learnt a lot from that. We sort of seem to see evidence that the universe is made up of a certain amount of dark energy and dark matter. It seemed to also corroborate some popular models of what happened in the early universe, in particular, this model of inflation that says that, you know, very soon after the Big Bang, the universe rapidly inflated at kind of an exponential rate. So why did we sort of need more measurements? What exactly was Planck trying to probe?
The big advantages that Planck has, one is that it's a much higher resolution, so it can see smaller structures on the sky. And the other is it has many more frequencies than WMAP. So for instance, the galaxy puts out a lot of radiation at the kind of frequencies that these satellites are looking at. And if you have more frequencies, you can more easily subtract out the galaxy's contamination. WMAP had 5 frequencies, Planck has 9.
And so let's talk about that better picture now. So what does it tell us about, I guess, the ingredients in the universe?
Planck gave us a slightly different recipe for the components of the universe. So before the Planck satellite, the percentages, it used to be something like 73% dark energy, 23% dark matter, and 4.5% ordinary matter. Now it's more like 68% dark energy, 27% dark matter, and 5% ordinary matter. So, you know, that's kind of nice because dark energy is the part we understand least. As somebody who studies primarily dark matter, it's nice to see there's a little bit more of that. So that changed a little bit. The age of the universe, Planck suggested a slightly higher estimate for the age of the universe. We used to think about 13.7 billion years. Now we're thinking maybe 13.8. So there are a couple of things like that. We've also gotten much better measurements of the non-Gaussianity. So the non-Gaussianity parameter sort of measures how skewed the distribution of the hot and cold spots are. And that's actually really important for models of inflation. So trying to understand the very first moments of the universe when it was expanding exponentially and getting a better idea of what kinds of models of inflation are still viable. And the non-Gaussianity puts some pretty strong limits on those. In the case of Planck, they're all basically suggesting a pretty simple set of inflationary models. I've heard, you know, people have said that they're quite disappointed because Planck seems to be ruling out a lot of really interesting stuff. And somebody has been calling it the maximally boring universe. And not everything that Planck found was, you know, boring, I would say. I think that it found some really amazing things. Like one of the things that I think is the coolest thing that they've done is they made a map of all of the dark matter in the universe. I mean, it's a very low resolution map. It's really noisy. Just, you know, a few blobs here and there. And but you can actually get sort of a picture of where all that matter is, and I think that's really amazing. One of the things that they were able to do, which is also amazing, is they were able to weigh some of the earliest galaxies in the universe by doing a correlation between the gravitational lensing effect they saw in the map and the infrared background light. So there's sort of background light in all directions at infrared wavelengths, and Planck was able to measure that and correlate that with the gravitational lensing. And the infrared background light, we think, it comes from the first star-forming galaxies in the universe, very early star-forming galaxies. And so they were able to make a measurement of the mass of those very early galaxies. I mean, it's a huge data set with all sorts of information in it, and it's just a goldmine for understanding a lot of things that are happening in the early universe.
You know, over the years, I've spoken to a lot of cosmologists and a lot of astrophysicists about, for instance, the WMAP data. And they were often sort of picking out very intriguing anomalies or strange or inexplicable features. There were things like giant cold spots or, you know, something called the axis of evil, which was like a special direction in the cosmic microwave background. And, you know, whenever I spoke to them, they sort of say, oh, you know, we need more data. We need, you know, the Planck satellite will tell us whether these features are really there or not.
So they haven't disappeared. So there's a set of things called the WMAP anomalies that are weird things in the data that basically Planck confirms those are really in the data. And it's not just an instrumental effect because they've now been seen in both of these instruments. And we don't really know what they mean. So you mentioned there's a cold spot. So if you just look at the Planck map, it's an oval-shaped map of the sky, and you have sort of blobs of red and blobs of blue. There's kind of a big blob of blue that sort of jumps out at you, and that's the cold spot. That's an anomalously cold region of the sky. It's colder than it should be, according to our models. We don't know why. So that's one thing that people have proposed certain very speculative exotic models to explain why that might be the case. There's an asymmetry between two halves of the sky. So one half of the sky has more variation, basically, than the other half. So it has hotter hot spots and colder cold spots. And the other half has sort of more moderate hot and cold spots. And we don't know why there should be a difference between one half of the sky and the other in terms of how much variation there is. There's also alignment. You mentioned it's called the axis of evil. If you take the map and you decompose it into spherical harmonics, which is kind of just a way of analyzing data on a sphere, there's an alignment between some of the modes that we don't expect to see. And those alignments suggest a preferred direction. And it happens that those alignments work out that the preferred direction is sort of perpendicular to the ecliptic plane, where the ecliptic plane is the plane of the solar system. And we really don't see any reason why that should be the case. It's not clear if these are all just coincidences or if they're telling us something, you know, deep and meaningful about the universe. And this is something that we have to figure out.
So, you know, you mentioned some of these kind of exotic and speculative ideas that people have been having. And of course, I guess the most famous ones are, you know, cosmologists suggesting that maybe these could be signs of collisions with other universes in the multiverse. And, you know, I've spoken to other cosmologists wondering whether the universe itself is rotating or just, you know, other weird objects existing in the universe. So I guess from this, what you're saying is this is good news for them. You know, it hasn't ruled anything out at this point?
Well, you know, I mean, even though some of these models are extremely speculative, you know, they generally can be ruled out. And we have ruled out some of those weird models. So like you mentioned rotational, you know, universe rotating. There are models of rotations in the universe where the whole universe is rotating in some way. And Planck was able to put really strong limits on that and rule out a lot of those models. Then the other thing you mentioned was collisions with other universes. There have been suggestions that if you have a collision between basically two universes, you can get patterns on the sky and you get sort of these big circles. And WMAP combed through the data to look for those kinds of signs of collisions and didn't see any of them. And so we can rule out some of those kinds of more exotic models. Yeah, there are cool, weird signals that we might have to come up with even weirder models to explain, but we don't really have free rein because this data is very precise. And as theorists, we have to work within those constraints. And there are a lot of things that we might have liked to do, like, you know, spin the universe, that are going to be a lot harder because of this Planck data. So it's kind of interesting. We can't just go on total flights of fancy.
Putting sort of those more exotic models aside, for astrophysicists like you, what are you looking forward to now? What will you be sort of looking for in that data or hoping for in future releases?
The main thing that Planck has not yet told us that we really want to know is about the polarization. So Planck measures not just the temperature on the sky, but the polarization of the light coming from these different places in the cosmic microwave background. And that polarization data has some really important implications for the early universe and for various kinds of models that we might want to be testing. So they're going to put out the polarization data sometime soon, and that will actually tell us a lot. And that'll be really exciting. So one of the things that the polarization data will be able to tell us about is gravitational waves from the early universe, basically. And so we'll be able to get some new information about inflation from that polarization data. So we're all kind of, you know, eagerly awaiting that.
Thank you to Katie Mack for taking Zia through those results. On our podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find a link to a blog post that Katie wrote for Physics Focus about the results, along with links to related articles about the cosmic microwave background. You can also follow Katie on Twitter at AstroKatie. That's AstroKatie. And of course, you can follow us at FQXI if you don't already.